This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. Robert Langer is a bit of a legend at MIT. He has more than 800 patents granted or pending, and he's been part of the creation of 25 companies, though hundreds more benefit from the results of his lab work. When a journalist from Nature followed Langer around for a day a few years ago, she found himself exhausted by his pace. So what does Bob Langer see ahead in his own groundbreaking research, which impacts everything from cancer to organ replacement to, well, hair care? He joins us now in Studio 3. Bob Langer, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm going to just start with, you know, this question of energy. If somebody asked you why you're so productive, how you've racked up so many patents and started so many companies, why did that happen to you? What would you say?
Well, I've been very lucky. I mean, being at MIT, I've just had fantastic students and postdocs. I mean, I really feel they're responsible for most of it. You know, I'm kind of maybe a catalyst and a cheerleader, but I've just had, you know, wonderful people, you know, so we've come up with some ideas and they've, you know, the students have just been fantastic.
Do you feel like it's partially that you start very early in the morning and work till late at night? Is it the amount of effort that you – is it related to the amount of effort that you put into your work?
Well, I work hard, but I think lots of people work hard. I mean, I do probably start early in the morning and work late at night, but I don't know if it's that. I mean, and so much of what we do is a team. You know, it's whether it's the people in our lab at MIT or whether it's the companies. I mean, all of these are team efforts, and so I think it's everybody pulling together to try to make things happen in the best way.
How did you first know that you really liked chemistry and engineering, and that was the field that you wanted to go into? I mean, was this something you knew when you were really young?
Well, they're probably different questions. I knew when I was very young, 10 or 11, my parents gave me this. They had what are called Gilbert sets, chemistry sets. And I had one of these Gilbert chemistry sets that you could mix chemicals together and you'd get colors changing. And I thought that – and you could make rubber and things like that. And I thought that was cool. And I like chemistry. Then engineering, though, I didn't know what engineering was. I mean, I was in high school and – my dad and my guidance counselor said you should be an engineer, and I didn't. They said because you're good in math and science, and I really thought being an engineer was running a railroad train. I wasn't sure why being math and science would help with that. You know, good in math and science would help with that. So I didn't know that part of it. You know, I went to college. I was a freshman at Cornell, and I, you know, majored in engineering, and I had to pick something, and chemistry was the only set of classes that I really liked and was actually decent at.
And how did you end up in academia rather than, as a lot of people do when they're engineers, they go into industry, they, you know, work for a big company?
Yeah. Well, when I was done, I mean, with my graduate work, I did look at a lot of companies. I had a lot of company interviews. In fact, I graduated in the 1970s, and then the big oil companies were hiring lots of people, and I was fortunate enough to get quite a few offers from all these oil companies. That's basically what most of my colleagues did. But I wasn't very excited about that. I wasn't excited about the impact that I thought I would make. I remember going to Exxon one interview, and they said, you know, if you could increase the yield of this chemical by 0.01%, that would be great. You know, it would make billions of dollars. And I just wasn't very excited about that. I remember flying back to Boston that night thinking to myself, I really don't want to do that. And so I, you know, looked for other kinds of positions. I was interested in educational things, and eventually nobody would hire me for that, and then I looked into medical things, and nobody would hire me for that either for the longest time. And then one of the people in the lab where I was at said to me, Bob, you should write to a man named Judah Folkman. He was a surgeon at Children's Hospital.
A pioneer in cancer research.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And he said sometimes he hires unusual people, and he was kind enough to hire me. And that changed my life.
Now, when you were making that decision, you were like, you know, I don't want to go work for Exxon and improve the yield 0.01%. Did people think you were crazy?
Yeah, they did, because I think that's what everybody did, and those were really secure jobs. Those were the highest paying jobs. People didn't really understand why I wouldn't do that.
Okay, let's jump to some of the work that you're doing now. You're really at the forefront of using nanotechnology in medicine. So I'm wondering, give us an overview. What do you think nanotech can offer in terms of medicine if you're looking out in the next, might be a few years, but it might be longer than that? What do you think, what promise does it offer?
Yeah. Well, first, I think it's important to understand what nano means from a practical standpoint that gives you certain advantages. So first, if something's really tiny, that means it can carry things into a cell that something big can't. And that might mean that you could deliver certain drugs like a cancer agent to a cell, for example. Secondly, another big advantage of nanotechnology is just kind of maybe almost obvious, but the surface area is so much greater. So in other words, if you had a lot of nanoparticles, the amount of surface would be enormous. And what that means is that if you had some signal that the surface was responsible for, it could be a lot greater. So with that in mind, let me just go over a couple things. One could be delivery. One of the things that we're doing, and that we started at MIT and at the Koch Institute, which is focused in on cancer research, and that now Bind Biosciences is doing, is having nanoparticles that hopefully could just take a drug and bring it right to a tumor. We started this work with Omid Farrukhidazad, who was a fellow in our lab and now professor at Harvard Med and the Brigham. And now Bind has treated something like over 30 patients using this technology. I even have some little particles here. You can't really see them.
Yeah, you've got a little. It almost looks like those airplane liquor bottles that you get. That's about the size it is, and it has some liquid in it. So what is that sort of whitish, milky liquid in the—
Yeah, so these are the whitish, milky liquid is our nanoparticles, and you can inject them in, into the bloodstream, and basically they find their way to the tumor more than any other place. In other words, it's still being worked on. But what's been exciting is that they have like an arrowhead that could zoom in on the target. And what we've been doing in the first clinical trial is, mostly determining safety. That's what Bind has been doing. And then, but there have been clearly some indications that it may be efficacious as well. And in fact, the Boston Herald had a significant article on this after we published the first paper in Science Translational Medicine, I think in April. And one of the things they highlighted was a woman whose life was saved by this, and I guess who was a professor actually in Arizona.
So the idea is that they can take little bits of medicine into just the tumor cells, and the way chemotherapy works now, right, is you basically, it's the hatch approach. You just kill all sorts of cells hoping to get the right ones.
That's right. I think you explained it very well. I mean, here what we're trying to do is zoom the nanoparticle with the drug in it right to the cells you want, the tumor cells, and hopefully to no other part of the body.
How do the nanoparticles know which cells are the tumor cells and which cells are cells they should not be attacking?
Yeah, so there's different ways that you can do it, but what we have is, like I mentioned, sort of a nano arrowhead that's directed to certain receptors that are called receptors on certain cells. They could be the tumor cells or they could be the tumor blood vessel cells. And so they recognize that. So basically we have a way of creating the surface of the nanoparticles in such a way so they recognize those particular cells, and that's where they go and stick.
So, okay, so you think nanotechnology has real potential to help with cancer? To treat it in different ways.
So that's one example. One example is in delivery. There's other examples of delivery too. Selecta Biosciences, which is another local company that Dr. Farrukhidazad and myself and Uli von Andrian started. It's in Watertown. They've been looking at nanoparticles for vaccine delivery to create new vaccines. There's a way that you can also target them to what are called immune-presenting cells. And actually, not only can you use nanotechnology for treatment, like I'm just saying, but you could use nanotechnology for much better diagnostics. So another thing that came out of we have a big cancer nanotechnology grant that was sponsored by the National Cancer Institute, and my co-principal investigator on this is a physician at Mass General named Ralph Weisleiter, and also Tyler Jacks, who's the head of our institute, and And Mike Sima is one of my colleagues, and David Lee, who's there, and Lee Josephson, they've all been involved. So basically, we created this company, T2 Biosystems. And there, what you can do is you can have little nanoparticles that can you can that are magnetic, and you can decorate them with things that will detect certain substances in the body. But because you put the magnet in there, you can get what's called a magnetic resonance signal. So if and that signal will change depending on whatever substance is in the body. So let's say we wanted to analyze, like right now you go to the doctor's office and you might not get a test result for 5 days or six
right.
days because it takes so long to process. But the beauty of this is that you can probably increase the signal by a factor of 100. This is the surface area advantage. So because you can increase the signal by an area of 100, rather than take 5 days, you could get a result maybe in an hour.
Okay.
And if the result was normally 2 hours, you could probably get it in a minute. And this is just the start. I think we'll be able to optimize it even more. So the point is that you could diagnose things much faster, and that may mean you'll be able to intervene in medical treatments much faster, like, say, to figure out the right antibiotic if somebody has a bad infection or things like that.
It's interesting. Just a few months ago, the MIT Tech Review, which is widely followed all over the world by people who are interested in technology, ran a piece called Why We Can't Solve Big Problems, which you may have seen. And on the cover was astronaut Buzz Aldrin, and under him was the headline, "You promised me Mars colonies. Instead, I got Facebook." And the question was, are we in this time where we can't solve big problems? Now, I want to pose that to you. It sounds from what you're saying like you feel like we are on the cusp of solving some big problems, but give me your sense.
Sure. Well, I could probably make a bad joke and say that nanotechnology is doing small problems.
That's true. Exactly.
But I won't. But I think that we're solving huge problems. I mean, you know, certainly I feel like at MIT and at the Koch Institute, we've been, you know, and that's, you know, there are all kinds of huge problems that people are solving. And I think that, you know, biology, I think, is at a particular time in history where people are making tremendous discoveries, and I think we've seen actually a transformation of how drugs are developed and how medical devices are created in the last 30 years. And I think we'll see, you know, with advances in genomics and other things, we'll see more and more advances in the next 30 years. So I think that certainly in biology and medicine, there's just a tremendous amount of transformation going on.
So when people say, I feel like nothing has happened in medicine in the last 20, 30 years, what happened with the war on cancer? We've still got people dying from cancer, right? I mean, Richard Nixon, you know, was involved in the war on cancer. When you hear people say that, do you think, yeah, but I can see over the horizon and there are very interesting things coming?
Yeah, well, I think progress – I mean, again, I think progress has been made – certainly some progress has been made in cancer, certainly a tremendous amount in terms of understanding the biology. And I think that's now beginning to translate to new drugs and things like that. And I think that there's – with nanotechnology and other advances that are going on, genomics, I think we'll see a lot more. But it does, in medicine, take a tremendous amount of time you know, because you ultimately have to test with humans and you have to go through the FDA, which you should have to go through, you know, to make sure things are safe. It doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen in 10 or 20 years. It's just a very, very hard thing. You make steady advances. So you can make a scientific discovery. Translating that scientific discovery into totally new medical treatments, you know, takes many, many years. And I think if we look at what happened with antibiotics or other things, that's what happened. Nothing happened overnight, and it's not happening overnight either here. But I think that there's a tremendous amount of big problems that are being solved. And you can just look. Boston is a fantastic hub for these biotech companies. They've done they've created all kinds of new drugs, you know, and medical devices that have, you know, save human lives in many, many different areas.
I want to talk about using nanotechnology to grow things too, skin and hearts and that kind of thing. And I wonder, what do you see there? Is there that potential to, you know, grow whole new organs that people may need as their hearts wear out, as if their liver gets messed up, that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, Jay Vacanti, who's a surgeon, he's had a pediatric surgery at Mass General, and I have been working really now for the last 30 years on this idea of tissue engineering. Now, a lot of people are working on it, but we helped get it started a number of years ago, where you could combine polymer scaffolds, plastic scaffolds with cells, and to try to make new tissues and organs. And I think that type of work, which other people have involved in too, and companies, you know, there are now artificial skin for burn victims, and there's so many different examples of where people are doing research, some in clinical trials now, to make all kinds of tissues and organs. And you mentioned heart, which is an example. That's going to be a longer range one, but there. But I think there are many different situations where technologies like this will transform what's going on. It, again, will take many years, but I think the results that have occurred so far have been very, very exciting. And, you know, really any situation where people may need new tissue, whether it's – and it doesn't need to be old people, sadly, either. I mean, sometimes young people need new heart tissue. You know, we've been working on things for spinal cord repair, and you know, there's a company doing that in vivo, and we're looking at with Steve Zeitels at Mass General new gels for vocal cord repair. There's just so many examples that you'd like to help with where people need new tissues or organs.
Now, give me a sense, how far away is some of this stuff from actually maybe really becoming part of our lives, so that if you needed vocal cord repair, it could be there. Or if you are on the list for getting a new heart or you need a new pancreas, I mean, how far away is this stuff?
I think it depends on what tissue organ we're talking about. Things that are structural probably will be faster than things that are, say, functional. So that's why something like skin, and I believe something like vocal cords. I mean, some of the big issues again are raising the funding and doing the clinical trials and so forth. But I think things like that will be faster than, say, something that's functional like a heart. It's very hard to give a time frame. I mean, artificial skin is already here. People use that, and that those have been successful for patients who have burns or diabetic skin ulcers and things like that. And then there are a variety of others that are in clinical trials, and you just have to see how well they do. Sometimes there's got to be a significant amount of iteration.
I wonder if you worry at all, and I've talked to people here. I think of Steve Goldstein, who's the provost at Brandeis, but also does biomedical research, and Art Kaplan, who's was at UPenn for many years, now at NYU. And they have said that they are worried that some of the very best and brightest people are leaving academia, leaving the kind of labs that you know, you work in, because it's very hard to find jobs. And they worry that it being so hard to find jobs, some of the next generation of the discoverers are not going to be there. Do you worry about that?
Well, yeah, I do. I worry about it. I guess what I worry about most is funding for basic research and science and engineering research, and I worry about funding for young people. But I worry about all of it. I think that has to be a concern. So I think they're right. I think, on the other hand, there's been wonderful things that have happened. Boston being a prime example of where, you know, you've had lots and lots of companies start from, you know, just ideas, and some of them have done very, very well, and they've created things that can, you know, really have a profound effect on human life.
Now, you've talked to President Obama, I think before he was president, and while he's president, about that issue of, you know, basic funding for the kinds of breakthrough medical technologies that we've talked about. What's going on with that funding? I mean, it stayed stagnant for quite a while, many years. Where do you see it going?
Yeah, well, I think we don't know. I mean, I think everybody's concerned about it. I think it's too early to know. You know, I don't know. I certainly don't think we're going to expect it to go up. This is, you know, funding from NIH and places like that.
Right, the National Institutes of
Health.
Yeah,
but I certainly, and places like the National Science Foundation too. to me, it's just incredibly important to fund those things, because that is what leads to cures, and that is, you know, what'll help keep great minds, you know, interested in doing this kind of, you know, work. So I'm concerned about it. I think we don't know yet. You know, I think it's my hope is that, you know, I've certainly talked with both Republicans and Democrats myself. I mean, not that that's my main job, but I was fortunate enough to meet Barack Obama when we were both getting honorary degrees at Northwestern in 2006. And just more recently, Eric Cantor was a Republican, was in the House, was up visiting MIT and the Koch Institute, and he also seemed to certainly understand that funding for research was really important. So I think we see it on from both parties.
Okay, well then, if President Obama and people like Representative Cantor, who's one of the leaders in the House, if they both agree that we should see more funding for the National Institutes of Health for medical research, then why has funding stayed essentially exactly the same for the National Institutes of Health for the last 10 years?
Yeah. First, I don't know that it's just them, and I don't know that they necessarily came right at it and said what you said. I wish they did. You know, I think politicians are probably fairly noncommittal, but they, you know, certainly Barack Obama, in his book, The Audacity of Hope, he spent several pages on his conversation with me on that. So he certainly understood that then as senator. But even if they're for it, I mean, those are just two people, and I don't know exactly, you know, their degrees. You know, I think that they're probably concerned with other things as well, you know, balancing the budget, giving money to hurricane victims, the military and stuff like that. I mean, I guess there's so I imagine there's all those kinds of issues they end up weighing, and then they have various constituencies in their parties that may feel differently, possibly, than they may have expressed to me.
Let's talk about some of the things that you brought in here. You brought in a microchip.
Sure.
And I'm wondering, you know, what are the implications of that? What can it do for us, do you think?
Yeah, well, The microchip. This is a sort of a larger version, but it's sort of almost like space age medicine. In fact, this was written up in the. We published another paper, the first human clinical trial on this, also in Science Translational Medicine, in 2012, and the Boston Globe, and actually the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, USA Today, all wrote about it. It was pretty exciting. Basically, what you can do here is, if you look really closely, we even have an antenna built into the back of this.
Yeah.
It's imprinted.
It's about the size of a couple of quarters lined up one after another. Yeah.
And it'll ultimately be a lot smaller. But basically, we have these wells, and they can be covered with a metal. And inside, and that's this is an example of that. And you can actually fill each of them with a drug, different doses of the same drug, or you could literally put different drugs in, literally have a pharmacy and a chip. And the idea is that, and it was done in the first clinical trial, is there was a little implant. We actually used it as a model to treat osteoporosis. That's a disease that women have where they have bone loss. And one of the ways of treating that is to give a drug called parathyroid hormone. Problem is you have to inject it every day. And you don't want to give it continuously either, which could take advantage of other things we've done, because if you give it continuously, that actually causes more bone loss. So you want to give it in a pulsatile fashion. So what was done in this case, so injecting it every day does that. But the big problem with injecting it every day is what's called compliance. 75% of the women who are supposed to do it, you know, they're 70 years old, don't.
Who wants to get injections every
day? Yeah, exactly. Right. So here there was a tiny little implant done in, say, 20 minutes. This was actually done in Denmark. This work, by the way, started in our lab at MIT with Mike Sima, who's a professor there, and John Santini, who was our graduate student. John started a little company called Microchips, which is in Waltham, and they made these. And so here what was done is you put this in, and you can actually, by remote control, just send a signal. It's almost like Star Trek. And a cap comes off, and out comes the drug. And then you can send another signal, and you can all this can all be programmed. And there's even a special code that if you want to change the program, you could do that. And so it's all done by – so basically the little wells come off – just the same way, like by radio frequency, the same way you open a garage door, you can open these up.
So instead of getting a shot every day, you just press the remote control and you say, this is how much medicine I need.
Well, you, in fact, you're right, but you can even do better than that. And so what's done in this case is the computer does it for you and actually does it because it's already built into the program, come out every day, say at 2 a.m. in the morning. So the woman's sleeping and it's already been programmed to come out. Hmm. So you don't even have to press it. It's been pressed for you.
A quick question for you. I want to get to this before we finish about
sure.
hair care, which we've been talking about this really serious stuff, but something else came out of your lab. It ended up being this thing we call living proof. It's a hair thickening product. How did that end up coming out of a lab that's working on cancer and organ regeneration and, dispensing medicine?
Yeah, well, a lot of it's all materials. And in the case of living proof, what happened was there's been a venture capital group, Polaris Ventures, and they've been terrific at helping us move things out of our laboratory into biotech and medical device companies. And one day, John Flint, who's one of the senior partners there, and Amir Nashat, who's a general partner and actually one of my former graduate students, came to see me, and they wondered if we could make contributions in the hair and skincare area. And when we looked at this, we thought, well, it's interesting. I mean, in hair care, the first thing that we noticed is that one problem that women have, men too, I probably am a good example, is your hair sometimes frizzy. And we looked at this, and there's about 40 companies trying to solve the frizz problem, and every one solves it exactly the same way. They use the exact same ingredient called silicone. And one of the things I noticed in medicine is that when people make medical products, a lot of times they just use things from their house. They don't necessarily give it a lot of thought. So if you look at it, like a lady's breast implant is actually a mattress stuffing because it's squishy. And the artificial heart is a lady's girdle material because it has a, like a heart, it's got a good flex life. And so we, Dan Anderson, who is one of my colleagues at MIT, and I, and a number of the people at Living Proof started saying, well, we could take a more fundamental approach. We don't have to, just use silicone. We could probably find materials that work better. And we found one, what's called a polyfluoroester, that keeps moisture out. That's part of the problem. Much, much better than silicone. And so that led to something called No Frizz. And that ends up working quite well. Living Proof markets that. And then another example is sometimes people want more body in their hair. They want it to be fuller. And Dan had designed a whole library of polymers that we were looking at for other medical purposes. So we had these patents on it. And there are thousands of polymers. You could use them for anything, medical things. But in this case, we looked at them for giving hair more body. And you could just go in and fish out the right polymer and find one that gives hair more body. And that led to what's called full, and so they've got a whole bunch of products like that at Living Proof.
And a final question for you. I wonder, do you ever worry about the danger between the intersection of academia and companies, company money coming in and funding research? Lawrence Lessig sat in that seat not that long ago from Harvard Law School, and he talked about research that had been done on cell phones and whether cell phones adversely affected you biologically.
Mm-hmm.
And the research that had been funded by the cell phone companies tended to show that it didn't, that cell phones were not a problem. But research that had been independently funded tended to show that cell phones did impact you biologically.
Sure. Sure. Well, I think it depends on what the situation is. I mean, the situation you're talking about is one where there might be a conflict of interest. My feeling is MIT has excellent rules, and probably even conservative rules to make sure those things don't happen. Most of the things that we end up doing are early stage things. So it's like if we got funding from a company, and we've gotten funding from companies as well as the government, it's to discover something or create new materials. So, the kinds of things you're talking about wouldn't happen. I mean, we're just trying to invent new things or discover new things. And if that could lead to a new drug or a new device for a company and the world, I'd be thrilled, and so would everybody else that's working on it. Mm-hmm. But there could be things like when you're talking about evaluating a product that a company makes, that's a very different situation. So I think you have to look at it and examine the whole situation.
Bob Langer, David H. Koch Institute Professor at MIT, thank you so much for coming in and joining us today and bringing everything.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The magic dragon lived by the sea.
And Edgar Herwick is here in Studio 3. Hey, what's going on?
Hey, Kara, how you doing? So, you know this song, I assume?
I do.
It's one of the more
famous
songs of all time.
Yes, I listened to it a lot when I was a kid.
Yeah, do you know who is responsible for this song?
Of course, Peter, Paul, and Mary,
yes,
the best.
And we are going to talk with one of the members of that band in just a second, the Paul from Peter, Paul, and Mary. And we're going to find out, among other things, why he's called Paul, because his name is actually Noel.
Oh, I'm very excited, and I'm sure my mom, if she's listening, is also extremely excited.
All right, Kara Miller's mom, listen up. Stay with us. I'm Edgar B. Herwick III, and you're listening to Boston Public Radio.
One gray night it happened, Jackie Paper came no more, and Puff, that mighty dragon, he ceased his fearless roar. His head was bent in sorrow, green scales fell like rain.